We're in the series on the rock or the block from which we were chipped, the story of Abraham, or at least some of the lessons that we can learn in reading about the so-called father, so-called, it's in the Bible, the father of the faithful, those who believe. And this will be the third one of those. We will not finish it, so we'll have at least one more part, and we'll just see how far we get. But if you were to summarize last week's sermon, which was part two, I would almost view it as a get-it-right sandwich. What we looked at last week was Abraham's or Abram's get-it-right sandwich. Now, you know, what do I mean by that? A sandwich. There's always three parts to a sandwich. On one end, you have a piece of bread, and then on the other end, you have a piece of bread, and those are alike, and then you have the stuff in the middle. Well, last week, we saw a get-it-right sandwich. What was in the middle was when Abraham or Abram got it right. We saw one of the high points of his life, I think, as far as spiritual maturity. On either side of that, the bread, the thing that was the bookends, he didn't get it quite as right as maybe he could have. So you'll remember we looked at really three major things. Call it the get-it-right sandwich. The first one was the whole Egypt episode, where he left the land of promise, where God had directed him to settle and live in faith and be patient. And yes, he was confronted with a severe or a pretty heavy trial. There was a famine. We understand that. Human logic says, what else could he have done? But is there anything too hard for God? Could God have provided for Abram if he had, in faith, stayed in Canaan? Well, could God, would that have been too hard? Well, I think we know the answer to that is easy. I mean, he provided 40 years worth of meals out in the wilderness for a whole nation of perhaps millions of people and their livestock. So it's not a matter of, was that too hard for God? Could God have kept Abram going in Canaan without him leaving there and going down to Egypt? The answer is apparently yes, based on what is elsewhere seen in the Bible. And then he went down there and got into a mess and all kinds of trouble. So that didn't start out too well. Then we have the last thing we looked at was him going to war. You know, the Bible says our warfare is, as Christians, as first fruits, it does not or should not involve physical weaponry. It's not a physical warfare. There's a lot of that going on in the world, but we're involved in spiritual warfare with spiritual weaponry and armament and all that sort of thing. That's made quite clear. That didn't go, or that wasn't his best moment. Now, it's true, God got him through it, but we'll see as we go through the story. That's a theme that God is merciful and gets his people through difficult situations, even when it wouldn't seem from a human weighing of good and bad that they had it coming. They deserved it, but God is so very merciful. But in the middle, the get-it-right sandwich, the part in the middle, I think, was Abram's, one of his finest hours in the part of the story we've looked at up until now. It had to do with the dividing up of the range for the livestock of Lot versus his own livestock, Abram's own livestock. And we see Abram, and this is how we ended it, I think, last time, or certainly spent a lot of time on it, doing things very well, in a spiritually mature manner. He had every right to demand the best land and send Lot somewhere else, but he gave Lot, younger than him, actually under him in authority in that patriarchal culture, he let Lot take the first choice, the best, what appeared to be the best land from a human perspective. And he was happy to take what was apparently second best, but to trust God to make it all come out. And I think that was Abram's finest hour. So we got through all that. That's just a summary of last week. We come now to Genesis 15. I haven't managed to tear that one out yet, but let's see by the end of this sermon. Genesis is kind of coming apart here. Genesis 15. Now, what I want to do here, the first part of the sermon, is just read Genesis 15 with you. It is really packed with important information. it's dense in that sense that almost every word, every verse is really packed with very significant information. If we're to be chips off the old block, it has a lot to do about God's dealing with the block and then Abraham or Abram responding to what God was doing. I think that should be something we remind ourselves as we go through this. The key is what was God doing, and only secondarily important, still important, but secondarily important was Abram responding to what God did in his life. So let's just read chapter 15 of Genesis. After these things, all the things we read about in the Get It Right sandwich from last week, after these things, the word of the Eternal came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward." Of all things, we see Abram with the case of the Yabuts here. In two successive back and forth between God and Abram, there's a little bit of, yeah, but what about this? Perhaps it surprises us at this point in his life to see that, but God is patient with him. Yeah, but that's what verse 2 is. But Abraham said, "But God, Lord Eternal, what will you give me? You just told me you're going to give me all these wonderful things, and you told me not to be afraid. But here's the way I see it. What are you going to give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" Of course, Damascus is up in Syria. And we just saw in the last sermon what he was doing up in Syria. He was chasing the four kings of the north who had taken Lot captive. But he'd been up there. He got a servant or some part of his household. And that's Abram's response to God appearing to him in this vision. Yeah, but all these things you promised, I don't even have one child. And the one who would inherit everything if I dropped dead today is not even of my family. It's this Eliezer of Damascus. Verse 3 then says, "Then Abram said, 'Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir.'" Not my blood, but somebody born in my house. "And behold, the word of the Eternal," so God replies, "came to him saying, 'This one shall not be your heir.'" It doesn't matter what your eyes tell you. He is Eliezer, or this one born in your house, or if they're the same person. That's not how I'm going to fulfill these promises to you. So don't worry about that. "This one shall not be your heir. But one who will come from your own body shall be your heir." It will be your biological offspring, be your biological son. Now verse 5. "Then he brought him out," God brought Abram out, "and said, 'Look now toward heaven and count the stars if you're able.'" Well, you can't. He couldn't then, and we can't now even with our biggest telescopes. There's trillions of stars. The naked eye can't count all the stars up there, and neither could our most powerful telescopes. Can't be done. I mean, it's a bigger blessing, it's a bigger future, it's a bigger fulfillment than anything you can count. "Look now toward heaven and count the stars if you're able to number them." And he said, "So shall be your descendants." And at that point, how many did he have? Zero. So you're going to go from zero to uncountable. That's the promise. And, verse 6, he believed him. At this point, it says he believed God. Not one bit of evidence except the word of God, and he chose to believe it. And God was very pleased with that. He believed in the Eternal, and he, the Eternal God, accounted it to him for righteousness. That is very pleasing to God, to see a human heart that actually believes God. It doesn't matter how impossible the promises seem. When a person believes God, it's very rare. It pleases God. So now we go to round 2 of this exchange. Verse 7. "Then he said, 'I am the Eternal who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees,'" that was his birth city, "'to give you this land,'" not some other land, "'this land, to inherit it.'" And here, above, really beyond what we would expect, again, we see another case of the Yabuts. So Abram replies, "Yeah, but God, how shall I know that I will inherit it?" That almost sounds like he's asking for a sign. Is it wrong to ask to God for a sign? Not always. If the attitude is right, God will sometimes honor that. He certainly did in the case of Gideon. And I guess we are to learn that a lot of it depends on the attitude. It already said he believed God. Apparently, in conjunction with that, it would not be wrong, or at least in this case, to ask for a little bit more evidence. God didn't refuse, and he didn't correct him. So he says, but how will I know? How will I know? How shall I know that I will inherit it? So verse 9. So he said to him, bring me five animals. Five animals are specified. A three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old female goat, a three-year-old ram. So those are large animals. And then two birds, a turtle dove and a young pigeon. So Abram did that. He brought all these to him, to God in effect, to offer them up, and cut them in two, down the middle. At least the three larger animals. He slaughtered them. He divided the carcass into two. So the picture we want to have in our mind is perhaps a few stones over here, perhaps built up as an altar. And then a few stones over here built up as an altar. And then a passageway through the middle. Now it just says in a couple of words, Abram did it. That's a lot of work. It's to slaughter three animals and two birds, carve them up, equal pieces, and then build up these, perhaps these altars right there. A lot of work. So it's not going to surprise us that he falls into a deep sleep after this. Oh, and there's one other thing. He's got to beat away the vultures. All this carrion is here, and here come the vultures. So it says he didn't cut up the two birds, but he cut up into basically equal parts, right down the middle, these three larger animals. And then verse 11, when the vultures came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away. So actually just a lot of work, physical exertion. Now verse 12, now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. That's not surprising, given the exertions that he had just been through. But he has a bad dream, or a scary dream. Horror and great darkness fell upon him in this vision of the night, or this dream. And when the sun was going down, that happened. So verse 13, then he, God, said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. Now, to you and me, 400 years, that is a long time. If God promises you or me really good, neat, desirable stuff, and then almost in the next breath says, oh, by the way, it's going to be hundreds of years before you'll ever see it, does that take the bloom off the rose? Does that cause us to disbelieve God? Do we suddenly throw the promises out and say they're not really neat and desirable anymore? Well, that's something that Abram is being tested on here. 400 years, that's certainly longer than Abram has yet to live in the flesh. So the promises include really wonderful things, but then the promises also include waiting. That's every bit as much promised by God as the really wonderful things at the end of that wait. And in fact, for Abram, the end of that wait is going to be the resurrection, because he doesn't live another 400 years in the flesh. Know certainly that your descendants, of whom you have currently none, will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them. You don't just have to wait. It's going to be hard waiting for many of them. 400 years of affliction. And also the nation whom they serve, I will judge. At the end of the day, nobody skates. Nobody gets away with anything. Righteous judgment will take place, but it's way, way down the road. And afterward, they, the descendants that have survived all this, will come out with great possessions. Now, as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Right there, there is another promise of God. You're never going to see these things that I've promised to you in this lifetime. Do we begin to see ourselves in the sandals of Abram in our calling a little bit in some aspects of this? You won't see it in this lifetime. But in the fourth generation, they shall return here. And then here's an amazing statement, verse 16. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Now, when you read elsewhere, some of the things going on with the Amorites, they were a pagan, sinful people, and that had been going on perhaps for quite a while, but God is so patient, he wasn't yet ready to dispossess them or wipe them out. He was going to give them more time. We sometimes wonder why things go on in this world. I mean, outside the church, even outside the Israels of God, why aren't they dealt with? They're awful. Well, here we have an example of God was not going to end awful things. And I guess maybe there was at least a sliver of a chance that some of these people would repent. Reminds me of Nineveh and Jonah. It hadn't yet gotten to the point where they all had to be destroyed and dispossessed. It wasn't yet to that point. Now, in our eyes, it would have long since gone past that point, but not in God's eyes. So verse 17, it came to pass when the sun went down and it was dark, that behold, there was a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between these pieces. So this walkway in our mind's eye where a person or God or an angel or at least fire could go between these two sides. On the same day, verse 18, the Eternal made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land. From the river of Egypt, well, if that's the Nile, and most commentators would say it is, to the great river, the river Euphrates, that is an extensive amount of real estate. In fact, at no time in recorded Bible history did the descendants of Abraham ever have all of that land under their control. Not even in Solomon's time, under their total control. So from that, we would say, to this day, these promises have not yet been completely fulfilled. Does that diminish them, or does it diminish the reality of them? Well, did it with Abram, and should it with anybody who reads this? Now, I want to kind of read through it with just a little bit of commentary, but I think there's even more that we could mine out of that chapter. I want to go back to the very first verse or two. Verse 1 says what it says. It says, after these things, the word of the Eternal came to Abram in vision and said, what? What was the key? Don't be afraid. That was the key that really is the theme of this entire chapter. And in fact, of much of Abram's life, and in fact, in much of the lives of the first fruits down through time. Don't be afraid. So when we read something like that, and we stop to think about it a little bit, the question arises, afraid of what? Had anything recently happened in Abram's life that would have caused him to be somewhat rattled? We'll use that term. That's more in our everyday language. The guy got rattled or afraid. Why else would God say don't be afraid unless he was somewhat afraid? What is it about what we've already read that would rattle Abram at least a little bit and cause God to encourage him and tell him not to be afraid? Well, I can see four things. There might be more. But I can see four things, most of which we covered last time, that could conceivably rattle him. And so it would make it the case that he needed encouragement, and he needed to be told these things by God. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. What would be those four things? Well, here's my candidate for these four things. Number one, the entire sojourn down in Egypt, that whole episode of him going down there, the sojourn into Egypt, I think now that he's back and he reflects upon it. You ever do that? You ever reflect back on the past year, the past few years about your life in the church, and you kind of wince when you look at some of those things, and it bothers you? Most people, I think, do. I mean, every year before Passover, we're told to examine ourselves. Not that we would get discouraged and not keep the Passover, but so that we would. But in any event, I think now that he's back in the promised land, he's doing a little reflecting on that whole thing of sojourning down in Egypt. And I think there were at least two aspects of that Egypt episode that could cause him to get rattled and maybe lose some of his confidence. Number one, it was ill-advised, I think, in the first place for him to go down there. He wasn't really trusting God as he had at other times. He didn't is again, I ask the rhetorical question, is anything too hard for God? He couldn't have taken care of Abram and his household in Canaan, even though there was a famine around him. What about verses that say that, you know, 1,000 will fall at your side, but God will take care of you? And many things like that in the Bible where when God chooses to do so, he can do miracles that will take care of his people in otherwise intolerable circumstances. Nowhere do we see God telling him to go down to Egypt. On the contrary, God had led him and directed him from Haran to the land of Canaan and said, "This is the land I'm going to give you to inherit, not somewhere else." But Abram had made the decision to leave Canaan and go to Egypt on his own when he was faced with a serious problem. And then he started getting in trouble and he played loose with the truth. We saw that last time. And he started to compromise and to try to get himself out of the problem he'd gotten himself into. He started playing loose with the truth and he got his family and himself in a mess. I think upon reflection, he's perhaps a little rattled when he thinks back on that, in the sense of, I am sure capable of making some bad decisions. At the time it seemed good, but look how easy it was for me to just use human reasoning, and one thing led to another, and I sort of reaped what I sowed, and I got everybody that I really care about in a mess. Actually, Sarah, his wife. That can rattle a person when they look back and see some mistakes they've made. It doesn't mean they haven't been forgiven of them, and it doesn't mean they haven't repented of them. Several times as we go through this chapter, I'm going to ask you just hold your place if you want to turn over. But I think there is a place in the New Testament that probably summarizes in one verse how this could have rattled him, the thoughts that would have been going through his mind as he reflected back on the decision to go down there and then what he did to try to get himself out of trouble and how it only made it worse. And I think that one verse might very well be Romans chapter 7. So here is another first fruit, a great apostle, a servant of God. And there were times when he came to this point and he wrote these words. This is Romans 7 and verse 24. "Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death?" That can be somewhat discouraging when a person looks back and sees how easy they fell into really bad decisions. So I think he was a little bit rattled by that. The second thing that I think rattled him was the episode of warfare that he got himself caught up in. And it certainly seemed like the right thing to do, to go rescue Lot, the four kings against the five, and what Abram did. And it is true, we talked about this at the end of the sermon last week, that God did deliver Abram and Lot in all of this. But once it was over, and I think he's reflecting on it, he may have realized, A, that it was a mistake. He wasn't, again, trusting God. But B, as he thought about the future, how easy it would be to get caught up in those same kind of turf wars. And when I say that, it's important to know a little bit about the geography of Canaan, the Promised Land. If you imagine in your mind's eye the face of a clock, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10, 11, 12. Over here, kind of on the northeast part of that face, call it 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, kind of the northeast area. Think that's Babylon, that's Assyria, that's Persia. These areas that gave rise to these great Gentile empires, militaristic areas. That's where the four kings came from that we read about in the whole Lot incident. Over at 1 o'clock, 1:30, 2 o'clock, over there. Then you start going counterclockwise back to 1, back to 12, back to 11 and 10. Maybe at 9 or 9:30, over here as you sweep around. That's Canaan. That's the Promised Land. Is that the quickest way to get from 1 or 1:30 to 9? Why don't you just go straight across? No, that's desert. So anybody that wants to get from where these empires would develop, and these four kings already were, they have to sweep this arc. And then if you're at Canaan at 9 or 9:30, then you come down to 6, 6:37, That's Egypt. That's another powerful nation. So this ark, and what's right in the middle between two very powerful, a succession of very powerful military empires that God isn't directly involved in, right in the middle, the Promised Land, where God says, I'm going to give this to you and your descendants. And so Abram just got caught up in one episode of this, but he's not a dumb man. And he says, this is going to constantly be the way it is. We're just a weak little tribe. There's other tribes that were here before us. And then this is kind of right in between Babylon, Persia, Assyria, and Egypt, the two big players in Israel's history. And it was always a tug of war. Who got the midpoint? Some point, these people had the midpoint, so they conquered Canaan for that reason. Other times, Egypt was in the ascent, and they got the midpoint. And Abraham's looking, we're always going to be facing this. We're always going to be right in the middle of these big guys, kind of like Poland in the modern world. That's what they say about Poland. It had the unfortunate destiny of being right between Germany and Russia. And the poor nation of Poland has been right in the middle of those wars for many, many decades, even centuries. And so that can be kind of frightening. Okay, God says here, nowhere else, here, and we're going to lay claim to this. These other people are going to laugh at us that we lay claim to this and that our God gave this to us. And you know what? That dynamic's still going on to this day. They would be right in the middle of an area coveted and fought over by powerful worldly forces. And that can be scary to think about that. And so what do you have again in the New Testament that would just say, yeah, well, that's been going a long time. What did Jesus tell the disciples? I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. If you worshiped the God of Noah and Abraham, and you're the descendants of that line, and you lay claim to that land, you're not going to be very popular, and others are going to say, we were here first, or you don't get it. You don't get to keep it. And I think Abraham's looking at that, not only what just happened, but what will happen, and that can be kind of scary. That can kind of rattle you. The third thing is the clear evidence that he had just had presented to him of how close he was to great evil. Not great power in this case, but great evil. He was very close to great evil. Because when he came back from the rescue operation, he was met by not one, but two individuals. One, Melchizedek. That's good. But the king of Sodom, where this great evil was centered. And he wasn't that far from it. And people of God, trying to obey God and serve God, it's kind of rattling. It's not pleasant. It's not fun or enjoyable to be surrounded by great evil. And he realizes it's just down the road at Sodom. It's distasteful. It can sometimes be discouraging and frightening for a person who strives to obey God and serve a holy God to be that close, right up next to terrible sinfulness and evil. That can rattle you. And then the fourth thing, I'll just say, time. I think the fourth thing that could have him somewhat rattled and feeling real vulnerable and perhaps even afraid, time. Now, what do I mean by time? Time filled with apparently unfulfilled promises from God. Choose my words carefully. Time that is apparently filled with unfulfilled promises of God. If you put the various hints together, he's now waited 10 years already. God appeared to him and said, you're going to have all these descendants, and you won't be able to count them, and my covenant is with you, and you're my special one, and I'm the creator of the universe, and you can trust me. A month goes by. A half a year goes by. A year goes by. 5 years go by. The evidence we have is now it's 10 years later. He was 75 when God first called him. Now he's perhaps 85. What's the old Tennessee Ernie Ford song? Remember that? You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Well, you get another day older and deeper in debt. So Abraham has waited for 10 years, and what has he got for his 10 years of waiting? He got 10 years older. He still hasn't had one biological child, And if you're going to have countless millions of them, you kind of have to have the first one to start, don't you? He's been waiting. He has none. No prospects of one. That can rattle people that are in covenant with God, who know God, because they like the promises. They like the end of the story. They read it and say, count me in. And then time goes by. And what do they get for 10 years of waiting? They get 10 years older. That's all their eyes can see. Well, what do they really get? They get 10 years of opportunity to trust God. They really get 10 years, but that takes a spiritual set of glasses. They've had 10 years of an opportunity to trust God, to not disbelieve Him, to walk by faith and not by sight. But it takes a spiritual set of glasses to look at those 10 years. A carnal set of glasses says, all I've gotten is 10 years older, and I have spent 10 years that are filled with unfulfilled promises of God. And that can discourage people. Abram and God's people, in general, live their lives in hope. They live their lives in hope, based on hope. We have wonderful, marvelous promises. That's why we're here today and not somewhere else. That's why we live the lives we do and not some other kind of life. We have a hope generated by fabulous promises from God. Unimaginably wonderful promises from God. Covenant promises. So the people of God deny themselves as they live in that hope. At times they suffer. And when they do, they are sustained by that hope. At other times they're tempted. And they tire of waiting. And sometimes they're tempted to abandon that hope. Sometimes God's people are even tempted to turn away from that hope. And that can be scary. The Bible actually tells us, this is in the book of Proverbs, in chapter 13, it describes this entire phenomenon that perhaps touches on one of the reasons Abraham was somewhat rattled or afraid. It's over here in Proverbs chapter 13, verse 12. God sees to it that these things are discussed openly in the Bible. We don't even have to discover them. They're right there. This is Proverbs 13 and verse 12. Hope that is deferred. What does that mean? You have to wait on it. What can it have the effect of doing? Make the heart sick. It can. It doesn't have to, but it can. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. When the desire comes, it's a tree of life. So I think those are at least four ways that we could see Abram at this point is somewhat afraid. You could put it lacking in confidence. Well, sometimes that can be a good thing, lacking in self-confidence, but I think he's a little bit rattled. And so God knows what his people need. I believe he knew what Abram needed, and that's why when we go back there, what I just described for you is, I think, the underlying reality of Genesis 15 and verse 0. You know, before we see what God did, we have to imagine the background. I think Genesis 15 and verse 0 is fear being rattled as he thinks about all these things. And knowing that that's what he needed, that's what he gave him. That's what Abram needed. That's what God gave him. And he says, don't be afraid. God ever do that for chips off the old block? I think he does it all the time. And if a person knows that they're in need of that, what would possibly be wrong with asking God for it, for encouragement, and to rejuvenate that hope? And to make it kind of like the fuel that makes the old car run. If we run out of hope, I don't know what keeps us going. Now, it says there in later in that chapter, let's see if I want to give you anything else. Just consider a few things in the Psalms. We go back to where Abram was maybe in Genesis 15 and verse 0. The backdrop, his psychological state when God said what he said. There's a number of places we could turn to. Let's just look at a sampler of those. Psalm 6. I think this might describe a theoretical Genesis 15 and verse 0. and it might describe at various times in your life or mine where we are. But if it does, we're in good company. So let's look at Psalm 6 and verse 2. Have mercy on me, O Eternal, I'm weak. What's wrong with telling God we feel weak and a little bit rattled? I don't think there's anything wrong with it. We see servants of God doing it all the time. This is David. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are troubled. My soul also is greatly troubled. He was rattled. But you, O Eternal, how long? He doesn't want to keep waiting, but he has to as long as God lets him wait. But he just confesses to God, I'm feeling kind of weak and rattled right now. There's another one a few pages later, Psalm 31 and verse 10. I mean, if God would not answer in mercy a prayer like that, I don't think anybody has a chance, but he does. So let's go later, another psalm of David. You and I don't normally think of David as a weak person, but at times he confessed his weakness. Verse 9 of Psalm 31, have mercy on me, O Eternal, I'm in trouble. Well, that's Genesis 15 and verse 0. I think all those four things were going through Abram's mind. Wow, what great promises. But I'm going to die before I ever see them, and my descendants will suffer 400 years before they ever see it even start to be fulfilled. That can trouble a person's mind unless they get settled down and attach themselves to that hope again. My eye wastes away with grief, my soul and my body. My life is spent with grief, my ears with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity. Again, as he reflected back on how easy it was for him to fall into a habit, or into an episode at least, of trusting his own thoughts and not God's, that it rattled him. And I am a reproach among all my enemies. He was surrounded by enemies. There were a lot of other people there in the Promised Land before Abraham's little troop got there and laid claim to it because God told them. They're surrounded by people that don't acknowledge that right. And as I said, they're in the crosshairs between the great powers over by Babylon and that one down in Egypt, and that was going to be the foreseeable future. There was one righteous king of Judah that made one notable mistake in his entire life. The rest of his life is sterling. But what was the mistake he got? Kind of like the one I think Abram did. He got caught up in the middle of a battle between, say, Babylon and Egypt. King Josiah, and for his troubles, he got himself killed. He was otherwise a righteous king. But, I mean, Abram could look forward. This is always going to be the case. We're right in this prime crosshair, and we're going to be in the middle of that. This is dangerous real estate to camp out in. Well, anyway, back here to this Psalm 31. My life is spent with grief, and my ears with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity, and my bones waste away. I'm a reproach among all my enemies, right? And especially among my neighbors, and the neighbor down the road is the king of Sodom and all of that, and repulsive to my acquaintances. You can read the rest of it. So this is maybe the kind of the psychological backdrop to the first couple of verses of Genesis 15. Maybe another one or two, Psalm 143. These are righteous people. These are people that know God, and we are privileged to read some of their prayers. And there would be nothing wrong with us adopting these as our prayers when it is appropriate, when it's necessary. So here we are in Psalm 143 and verse 7. Answer me speedily, O Eternal. My spirit fails. Don't hide your face from me, lest I be like those who go down into the pit. If something doesn't happen, I'm on a one-way ticket to disaster and destruction. There again, a Psalm of David. Psalm 28. I mean, the Psalms are really full of verses like that, or prayers like that. And I think this is kind of descriptive of Genesis 15, verse 0. Psalm 28, verse 1. To you I will cry, O Eternal, my rock. Don't be silent to me, lest if you're silent to me, I become like those who go down to the pit. It's not wrong, so long as the attitude is right, to be bold with God, with our needs. This sounds like boldness to me. If there were one verse, I think, in the whole New Testament that kind of sums all this up. Again, it's the Apostle Paul. This psychological and maybe even spiritual frame of mind that we see as we lead into Genesis 15. I would think maybe 1 Corinthians 15 would sort of describe that. Excuse me. So, promises. Wonderful promises. That's the setting. God makes wonderful promises to Abram. And then there's the reality of all these other things, and there's waiting involved. Well, anybody in the new covenant is basing their life on, again, wonderful promises, indescribable promises, eternal life, but there's waiting. And if what if we did all that waiting? And what if we did all that self-denial? And what if we did all that suffering and fill in the blanks, and it turned out to all be a lie? Who would be the most pitiable people that have ever lived? Well, the first fruits were. It's not a lie, but what if it were? That's what's being explored here in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 19. Paul puts it this way. If in this life only we have hope in Christ, we're of all men the most pitiable. If the fulfillment of these wonderful promises turned out not to be true, the most pitiful people are those that base their whole life on them being true, and then they weren't. Now again, it's not that they aren't true, but Paul addresses that. The most miserable, the most to be pitied, would be somebody who did all of that, endured all of that, waited that much, and it turned out it was all for nothing. Well, it's not all for nothing. So we go back to Genesis 15. So Abram waits in hope. And near the end of the chapter, where all those animals were sacrificed and cut up in this dream, and then this miraculous torch or flame that consumes the offering, there's an interesting expression here. So we go back to Genesis 15 and verse 18. It says, on the same day, the Eternal, quote, made a covenant, end quote, with Abram. And then he repeats some of these promises. To your descendants, not to you, you'll see it on the other side of the resurrection, but to your descendants, I've given this land, and so on. Well, the words made a covenant, in our mind, maybe evoke signing a contract or something like that between two equals. Really, that's not quite the accurate picture, and it's not quite the best translation. If you look at the Hebrew authorities, they tell us what gets translated, made a covenant, literally means cut a covenant. These animals were cut in two. The idea, perhaps, is a person who enters into a covenant with God and cuts these animals to, is in a sense saying, I am so much on board with these promises, and I so much am convinced that God's way is best and these promises are true, that if I ever abandon it, may God cut me in little pieces. That's kind of the thought behind it. These animals are in cut pieces. I would be deserving of that, to be cut up into little pieces if I ever walked away from something this wonderful. God cuts a covenant. He cuts a relationship. He enters into a binding promise with him based on divine promises of God who cannot lie. This that we just read here is a restatement with emphasis of some of the things that had originally been said back in chapter 12. So in doing all of this, God reminds Abram that the promises underlying this covenant are staggering. They're huge. They're way bigger than Abram could ever have thought up on his own. Just like you can't count the stars. Well, you can't fully ever have come up with something this wonderful and this big on your own. Does that remind you of anything in the New Testament? That the plan of God, the promise for the first fruits, is greater than anything anybody could ever come up with. Well, it's basically the very words of the book of Ephesians, chapter 3. I'll read that to you. There's a continuity between the Old and the New Testament. Much of what the theology, in fact, much of the theology of the New Covenant is a commentary on what God was doing in the life of Abram. Because really, the life of with Abram was, in some sense, the beginning of the new covenant in Christ. You are Abraham's seed if you are in Christ, there is a connection between being a chip off the old block of Abraham spiritually and being in covenant, the new covenant, through Christ. So here we have this statement in Ephesians chapter 3. Verse 20. This sounds very much like what we just read in Genesis 15. To him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, to him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus throughout all ages, world without end. Above the ability even to think. So what person, having never read the Bible, could ever dream up anything as spectacular as the truth? That God's purpose in giving that person life, in giving any human being life, is to make them a member of the God family ruling the universe forever. Whoever would have come up with that on their own? It's greater than the mundane, the everyday. So that's why, look up. Don't look around or down. Look up, he told Abram. And you can't do that. You can't count the stars. Well, you can't fully grasp how great this covenant, these promises are. So it's not passively just admiring them. It says Abram believed. But this belief is not just passive admiring what a wonderful thing it is. It's having one's life and actions affected by that belief. We don't just admire how wonderful it is and then go off and live in sin. We see how great it is, we believe it, and then we live a life based on that belief. Romans chapter 4, having our behavior, our thoughts affected by the fact that we do believe those promises. Let's look at a few things here in Romans chapter 4. We'll begin in verse 11. Romans 4 and verse 11. And again, this is highly theological text here, and guess who's front and center in the middle of it? Abraham. The new covenant in Christ, and Abraham's being discussed. So at Romans 4 and verse 11, he, Abraham, received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while still uncircumcised. Now, in one sense, we're a little ahead of the story here. We haven't gotten to this part of it yet. We will. That he might be the father, the progenitor, you know, the block from which everything else is chipped, the father of all those who believe, though they are uncircumcised, though they don't have Abraham's physical DNA, they have his spiritual DNA. And that's what's important. Gentiles, though they are uncircumcised, that righteousness might be imputed to them also. Now we go down to verse 16. Therefore it is of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Moses, circumcised in the flesh. That's the physical DNA. But it's talking about the spiritual seed. Not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Church members. And, you know, it might be good to once again just say, yes, there are two or three or four, a few exceptions. There were a few that we expect to see in the first resurrection who lived before Abram, righteous Abel. And but not many, certainly not many mentioned in Hebrews 11, Noah. But so those are exceptions. But the general point is this enterprise begins with God working with Abram and the seed, the promised seed. So we keep reading here, Romans 4 and verse 17. As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations in the presence of him whom he believed, even God, who gives life to the dead. How am I ever, Abraham must have thought, how am I ever going to see the fulfillment of these promises if God just told me I'm going to die before they even start to be fulfilled? Well, inherent. And the answer is there has to be a resurrection. You're not going to stay dead. You're going to be resurrected. God who gives life to the dead, and calls those things which do not exist as though they did. Now again, does the passage of time change that? I've been waiting 10 years. What have I got to show for it? I've gotten 10 years older. Have the promises diminished or been negated at all by the passage of time? Answer, no. They're just as fresh, just as real, just as true. Before we see them, during seeing them, and after we see them, the Word of God never fails. So He calls those things which do not exist as though they did. You're going to be the father of many nations. That's your name. And you don't yet have one biological descendant. But it's every bit as real. Who, contrary to hope, in hope believed, so that he became the father of many nations, according to what was spoken, so shall your descendants be. And then we go over a couple of books, Galatians chapter 3. Again, highly theologic material. Plan of God. Function of Christ in the plan of God. And right at dead center is Abraham again. Galatians 3 and verse 6. Just as Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Therefore, know that only those who are of faith are sons of Abraham. And the Scriptures, foreseeing that God would justify the nations by faith, preached the gospel to Abraham beforehand, saying, in you all nations shall be blessed. The fulfillment of that is Christ. So then, those who are of faith are blessed with believing Abraham. Then one other thing in this chapter, I said it's just so loaded with very important patterns that God dealt with the progenitor, Abraham, but the same patterns are played out in the lives of the first fruits down through the centuries. Back to chapter 15 of Genesis was this statement, verse 13. You know, wonderful things are promised, but then other things are promised. They're all promised. Here's another promise of God. There's going to be opposition to this whole plan. And sometimes you and your seed are going to get caught up in the midst of that opposition. That's a promise. It shouldn't surprise you, Abraham, when it happens. It shouldn't surprise a chip off the old block when it happens. It's going to happen. Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. So opposition to what God is doing in the life of the first fruits is promised to the first fruits. It goes with the territory. It's every bit as much a promise as the good stuff. And with spiritually mature glasses on, it can be viewed as part of the good stuff. I would say the apostles were fairly spiritually mature, and they suffered real opposition. And on one occasion it says they rejoiced that they were counted worthy to suffer for righteousness' sake. That takes real maturity. I don't know that I'm there yet. I don't know how many of you are there yet. But it's something that's held out there as an example of great spiritual maturity. So opposition was promised to Abram by God. And it's promised to those who are the physical, the spiritual, and the physical descendants of Abram. It's one of the constants in this world. If you find the seed of Abraham, you're going to find people who are jealous of it, in opposition to it, wanting to destroy those people. And so, just as God promised, it was fulfilled. Exodus chapter 1, just a little bit of that story. And the things that had been promised to Abraham's seed, maybe not the ones they wanted so much, but they happened. Exodus 1, beginning in verse 8, says, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Okay, so yesterday we changed administrations in this country. Now I can remember back 25 or 30 years, so can many of you. Pick a president who seemed to be making big waves and a big impact on the nation, and it seemed like this is important. 20, 25, 30 years later, you talk to high school students, they couldn't even tell you who that person was. when you get old, like some of us here, it's like that's a fresh memory, and yet maybe going on to a majority of the people alive in this country couldn't even tell you that person's name or much about them at all. So this didn't take all that long. The point is, Joseph, well, as long as Joseph was around, his brothers and sisters and cousins, they were protected and, you know, hands off of anybody associated with Joseph in Egypt. Well, when Joseph dies, it doesn't take that long. 20, 30, 40 years, who's Joseph? Some new powerful king? That's what happened. There arose a new king over Egypt who didn't know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we are. Come and let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it happened in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us. And so go up out of the land." So now the promise of 400 years of oppression is beginning to be fulfilled. Or at least that's one way to understand one starting point of this fulfillment. "Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens." Wait a minute, we're the descendants of Abraham. We're supposed to inherit the promised land and all these good things. Yeah, but there's going to be a period of time where it's not going to be so pleasant. "And they built for Pharaoh supply cities," and so on and so forth. So we read over in chapter 2, now verse 23. "It happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage," and it had really gotten bad. And when it really gets difficult for people of God, does that mean it was all just a fantasy, and there isn't really a God, and he's not involved and isn't watching over us? No, it didn't mean that then. It doesn't mean it now. It's time now for God to deliver them from this bondage. So they groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and now it's God's time. "And their cry came up to God because of the bondage, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, and then with Isaac and Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them." So in that period of time, between when the groaning starts and God does the miraculous intervention, there is a need for not being afraid and not fearing that the whole thing was a lie, and to endure in that hope. Let's look at a few examples. Psalm 83. And I would say that's where most of God's people are now, to one degree or another. Psalm 83. But the whole point of this is when God saw that Abram really needed like a jump start or a replenishment of his hope and courage, God saw to it that he got it. And there is absolutely no difference between then and now, and God does the same for you and me, especially if we ask him. Psalm 83, verses 1 through 4. "Don't keep silent, O God. Don't hold your peace. Do not be still, O God. For behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones." And they're not feeling all that sheltered at this time when they recount this to God. "And they," these enemies, "have said, 'Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.'" The point is, we're just going to take a real, we're about through today, but we're going to take a real brief tour just to dip our toes in the waters of seeing these promises. Not only the good stuff, but of the things that will have to be endured, those are also promised and they were fulfilled. And it's always been the case. So that's kind of a summary verse. We go back a few pages to Psalm 44. "So I should not be shocked or surprised when difficulties present themselves to me, and neither should you, if we're chips off the old block. It goes with the territory." Psalm 44 and verse 9. "But you have cast us off and put us to shame." Sometimes people think that way. "And you do not go out with our armies, spiritual or physical." Sometimes people think that. "You make us turn back from the enemy, and those who hate us to have taken spoil for themselves. You've given us up like sheep intended for food." What did Jesus tell his disciples? I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Really, nothing changes. Verse 13, you make us a reproach to our neighbors, a scorn and a derision to those all around us. You make us a byword among the nations, a shaking of the head among the peoples. This is a fulfillment of a promise of God that it would be like this. So it should not be shocking nor surprising when it happens. Another thing in Israel's history, at least physical, is the book of Esther. Every time you read that, realize how apparently close it came to it all being over. One verse, Esther 3 and verse 6, apparently close it came. Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. Well, that would include about all the Jews in the world. To human eyes, it looked like it was over. Well, it wasn't over at all, and it wasn't even really close, but it looked to be. That's the point. There are realities going on beyond human eyes that we can have hope and trust in God. Galatians 4, verse 22. Again, a little bit later in the story of Abraham, but Paul is making spiritual covenant teaching based on, again, on something in Abraham's life. So he draws a lesson from two. Well, that's two more than he had to this point. Two physical, biological sons of Abraham. One was named Ishmael and one was named Isaac. One was from Hagar and one was from Sarah. But this is said in Galatians 4, verse 22. It's written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh. And we'll get into that later in the story. Another example of when even servants of God sometimes act like they're still running the show. And it's up to humanly devised ways to solve problems, which really can only be solved spiritually. That's what we call the Hagar syndrome and the Ishmael syndrome. That was according to the flesh, according to a humanly devised plan. But then you have Isaac being born of Sarah, and there was nothing human about that. It was miraculous from start to finish. And then, when you have the humanly devised approach and the miraculously provided approach, there's going to be conflict in that scenario. Verse 28 says, "We, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise. But as he who was born according to the flesh then persecuted him," Ishmael and his mother, in some senses, persecuted Isaac, who was born according to the Spirit, even so it is now. It's always been a part of the equation. So again, we need not be surprised or shocked when it happens. Some of the last words Jesus gave his disciples. He said this to comfort them and encourage them, just as he did to Abraham in Genesis 15. Not to discourage them, but to revivify their hope and to encourage them. He said in John 15, verse 19, "Because you are not of the world," John 15, verse 19, "because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world therefore hates you. They persecuted me, they will also persecute you. These things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me." So it should never, ever be a surprise when things that God has promised come to pass, either the ones we desire or the ones that we have to endure and trust him in the middle of. All the promises of God are true. And as God said to Abraham, as he says to you and he says to me, do not be afraid.